Chapter 61. Tree speaks to stone, stone speaks to water. January to February, 1817. When Mr. Norrell had destroyed Strange's book, public opinion in England had been very much against him, and very much in favour of Strange. Comparisons were made, both publicly and privately, between the two magicians. Strange was open, courageous, and energetic, whereas secrecy seemed to be the beginning and end of Mr. Norrell's character. Nor was it forgotten how, when Strange was in the peninsula, in the service of his country, Norrell had bought up all the books of magic in the Duke of Roxburgh's library so that no one else could read them. By the middle of January, the newspapers were full of reports of Strange's madness, descriptions of the Black Tower, and speculations concerning the magic which held him there. An Englishman called Lister had been at Mestre, on the Italian coast, on the day Strange had left Venice and gone to Padua. Mr. Lister had witnessed the passage of the Pillar of Darkness over the sea, and sent back an account to England. 3 weeks later, accounts appeared in several London newspapers of how it had glided silently over the face of the waters. In the space of a few short months, Strange had become a symbol of horror to his countrymen, a damned creature, scarcely human. But Strange's sudden fall from grace did little to benefit Mr. Norrell. He received no new commissions from the government, and worse yet, commissions from other sources were cancelled. In early January, the Dean of St. Paul's Cathedral had inquired whether Mr. Norrell might be able to discover the burial place of a certain dead young woman. The young woman's brother wished to erect a new monument to all the members of his family. This entailed moving the young woman's coffin, but the dean and chapter were most embarrassed to discover that her burial place had been written down wrongly, and they did not know where she was. Mr. Norrell had assured him that it would be the easiest thing in the world to find her. As soon as the dean informed him of the young lady's name and one or two other details, he would do the magic. But the dean did not send Mr. Norrell her name. Instead, an awkwardly phrased letter had arrived in which the dean made many elaborate apologies and said how he had recently been struck by the inappropriateness of clergymen employing magicians. Lascelles and Norrell agreed that the situation was a worrying one. "It will be difficult to sustain the restoration of English magic if no new magic is done," said Lascelles. "At this crisis, it is imperative that we bring your name and achievements continually before the public." Lascelles wrote articles for the newspapers, and he denounced Strange in all the magical journals. He also took the opportunity to review the magic that Mr. Norrell had done in the past 10 years and suggest improvements. He decided that he and Mr. Norrell should go down to Brighton to look at the wall of spells that Mr. Norrell and Jonathan Strange had cast around Britain's coast. It had occupied the greater part of Mr. Norrell's time for the past 2 years, and had cost the government a vast sum of money. So, on a particularly icy, windy day in February, they stood together at Brighton and contemplated a wide stretch of featureless grey sea. "It is invisible," said Lascelles. "Invisible, yes," agreed Mr. Norrell eagerly, "but no less efficacious for that. It will protect the cliffs from erosion, people's houses from storm, livestock from being swept away, and it will capsize any enemies of Britain who attempt to land. But could you not have placed beacons at regular intervals to remind people that the magic wall is there? Burning flames hovering mysteriously over the face of the waters, pillars shaped out of seawater, something of that sort?" "Oh," said Mr. Norrell, "to be sure. I could create the magical illusions you mentioned. They are not at all difficult to do, but you must understand that they would be purely ornamental. They would not strengthen the magic in any way whatsoever. They would have no practical effect."
"Their effect," said Lascelles severely, "would be to stand as a constant reminder to every onlooker of the works of the great Mr. Norrell. They would let the British people know that you are still the defender of the nation, eternally vigilant, watching over them while they go about their business. It would be worth 10, 20 articles in the reviews."
"Indeed," said Mr. Norrell.
He promised that in future he would always bear in mind the necessity of doing magic to excite the public imagination. They stayed that night in the Old Ship Tavern, and the following morning they returned to London. As a rule, Mr. Norrell detested long journeys. Though his carriage was a most superior example of the carriage-maker's art, with everything in the way of iron springs and thick padded seats, still he felt every bump and dent in the road.
After half an hour or so, he would begin to suffer from pains in his back, and aches in his head, and queasinesses in his stomach. But upon this particular morning, he scarcely gave thought to his back or his stomach at all. From the first moment of setting off from the old ship, he was in a curiously nervous condition, beset by unexpected ideas and half-formed fears. Through the carriage glass, he saw great numbers of large black birds, whether ravens or crows he did not know, and in his magician's heart he was sure that they meant something. Against the pale winter sky, they wheeled and turned and spread their wings like black hands. And as they did so, each one became a living embodiment of the raven in flight, John Usklas's banner. Mr. Narrow asked Lascelles if he thought the birds were more numerous than usual, but Lascelles said he did not know. After the birds, the next thing to haunt Mr. Norrell's imagination were the wide, cold puddles that were thickly strewn across every field. As the carriage passed along the road, each puddle became a silver mirror for the blank winter sky. To a magician, there is very little difference between a mirror and a door. England seemed to be wearing thin before his eyes. He felt as if he might pass through any of those mirror doors and find himself in one of the other worlds which once bordered upon England. Worse still, he was beginning to think that other people might do it. The Sussex landscape began to look uncomfortably like the England described in the old ballad. This land is all too shallow, it is painted on the sky, and trembles like the wind-shook rain when the Raven King pass by. Footnote 1. See Chapter 3, Footnote 1. For the first time in his life, Mr. Norrell began to feel that perhaps there was too much magic in England. When they reached Hanover Square, Mr. Norrell and Lascelles went immediately to the library. Childermas was there, seated at a desk. A pile of letters lay in front of him, and he was reading one of them. He looked up when Mr. Norrell entered the room.
"Good. You're back. Read this."
"Why, what is it?"
"It is from a man called Traquair. A young man in Nottinghamshire has saved a child's life by magic, and Traquair was a witness to it."
"Really, Mr. Childermas," said Lascelles with a sigh, "I thought you knew better than to trouble your master with such nonsense." He glanced at the pile of opened letters. One had a large seal displaying someone's arms. He stared at it for several moments before he realized that he knew it well and snatched it up.
"Mr. Norrell," he cried, "we have a summons from Lord Liverpool."
"At last," exclaimed Mr. Norrell.
"What does he say?"
Lascelles took a moment to read the letter.
"Only that he begs the favour of our attendance at Fife House upon a matter of the utmost urgency."
He thought rapidly.
"It is probably the Yeonites. Liverpool ought to have requested your assistance years ago to deal with the Yeonites. I'm glad he realizes it at last. And as for you," he said, turning upon Childermas, "are you quite mad, or do you have some game of your own to play? You chatter on about false claims of magic while a letter from the Prime